Welcome to Dialogue Out Loud. I'm Margaret Olson Hemming, one of the editors at Dialogue, a Journal of Mormon Thought. Today's episode features a conversation with Nathan Kitchen and Makoto Hunter, whose essays appear in the special roundtable in our forthcoming spring issue. The roundtable reflects on the 10-year anniversary of the November 2015 policy, often referred to as the exclusion policy. In that moment, the policy reshaped how many Latter-day Saints understood belonging, family, and participation in church life, particularly for LGBTQ members and their loved ones. A decade later, we're still living with its effects, even after its reversal. In this conversation, we'll explore memory, theology, and the evolving meaning of belonging, both within and beyond institutional structures. Nathan and Makoto, thank you both for being here.
Thank you so much for the invitation.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.
So I want to talk a little bit about the pieces that you each contributed to this roundtable, which was half a dozen people responding to this 10-year anniversary. Nathan, why don't we start with you, and you can describe what you wrote and how you decided to choose this perspective on this this anniversary date.
Oh, sure. You know, as I begin in my essay, I was really just very knee deep in the exclusion policy in the queer Mormon advocacy world, in my work with Affirmation, both when it happened and then as it continued to linger on for, you know, a good 3.5 years. And by the time it was rescinded, I was actually president of Affirmation. And so I kind of wear three hats when I think about the exclusion policy, especially after this 10-year period. Enough time has passed that I can put on maybe a historian hat and start to really assign meaning to, you know, what did it all mean? But I also really am a primary source because I lived it with, as a gay father of 5 children when the exclusion policy came down. I was square in the target of what was happening. And on top of that, I also, was a leader in the queer Latter-day Saint intersection with an Affirmation, eventually, of course, being its president. So, you know, I wear three hats as I kind of think back to what this time was like. And having been involved in Affirmation, I've kind of been able to see, you know, Affirmation is almost 50 years old. So I've been able to see kind of like the wide swath of what queer Latter-day Saints have been thinking about and doing ever really since the rise of the modern church in the 50s and 60s until now. And so it really helped me put on kind of a context of what was happening with the exclusion policy. And I really feel like it was something important to say and to tell, because I would love to be able to say and tell how the things that I felt and not have to leave it for our future historians to kind of parse together what I may or may not have been feeling. So thank you for giving me this opportunity to be able to really bear my soul. I know I did some of that in my book, The Vows of Love, and that was a very personal point of view of how I intersected with the exclusion policy, me and my children. But this allowed me to give, you know, maybe a 30,000-foot view of how it just really affected us as a collective queer community at this time.
Yeah. So valuable to have your perspective as someone who was right in that community and saw the before and the after. Thank you for that contribution. Makoto, you have a very different perspective, and your essay took me completely by surprise in the most beautiful way. Could you share, the approach that you took and how you decided to get there?
Yeah, first, that's really very kind. I don't know how obvious it is that I'm like trying not to grin too much. But yeah, so while Nathan, you know, felt squarely within the target of the exclusion policy, really experienced it as it happened, I end up writing about how I kind of didn't experience it. In 2015, I was what a lot of people would call today an egg. I didn't even think of myself as being transgender. I had experiences and feelings, but I never thought to myself, oh, I'm really a girl. I was just sort of going through my life as a pretty normal Latter-day Saint boy, as far as I knew. And so the exclusion policy pretty much drifted right past me. It's as far as I remember, it was years later that I even found out it happened after it had been rescinded. Mm. So when I end up writing is in a sense how I became someone who did care about and notice the exclusion policy, right? How I learned about it when I was still an egg, so to speak, an unhatched trans woman, how I later continued to think about it as I came out to myself, to others. And I end up also pluralizing the exclusion policy. I write in my title that I write about the policies, and I think about not only the 2015 policy targeting sort of the children of parents in same-sex relationships, but also thinking about other kinds of sexual and gender alterity that the church has made policies about, and how I kind of conceive of them as being part of the same fabric. So that's what I wrote and how I got to what I wrote.
Yeah, thank you. I think for both of you, you're thinking as historians, but in different ways. So Nathan, you're documenting things sort of for the future, and Makoto, you pull in these really interesting ideas from the past and how it has affected current ways of being or current sort of policies in the church, but both so helpful. And for me personally, just gave me a very different understanding of what happened during that time. Makoto, you talk a lot about not noticing things earlier in your life. What do you think that says about how church culture shapes what we're even able to see or question?
Yeah. So, I mean, I already mentioned, right, I didn't notice the exclusion policy. I didn't seem to know about it in 2015 or in 2016 or, you know, for years. I didn't notice that I was trans, right? I had feelings and thoughts and experiences, but I never sort of assembled that together into the idea that I might not be a boy. As far as what it said, and there's other things I think in the essay as well. As far as what it says about church culture, I mean, in a sense, it says like it's like the old aphorism about fish swimming in the water, right? What the heck is water? We often don't know what we're swimming in, and that was true of me too. I didn't even think that boys didn't feel the way I felt. Mm-hmm. There's a bit of an irony here, right? Because, you know, if we go back to things that Joseph Smith, sort of the founding prophet, teaches, right, that we believe we have a right to embrace all truth without limitation, without being circumscribed. So it's almost a bit strange to think that I was prevented from seeing or questioning some things I was experiencing, some things I was encountering.
It's interesting to think about your own journey of the awareness of what water is or what is surrounding you. Nathan, you described the exclusion policy as both deeply traumatic and strangely galvanizing. How did it change your sense of what the church was and your place in it?
Well, sure. You know, let me first address the trauma, and then I will finish by talking about the galvanizing empowerment that the policy brought about in the Queer Latter to Saint community. So, you know, for me, the day after the exclusion policy appeared, I took my sons to a Phoenix Suns basketball game. And as I was sitting in our seats, I was trying to do the dad thing, taking the dad selfie with all of us. And I noticed that my hands were just shaking uncontrollably. And it's very uncharacteristic. Usually a very steady hand as a dentist. And it was very uncharacteristic. I could hardly keep the camera in on track there. And I had to sit down. I couldn't even catch my breath. And I realized that I was undergoing a full-on panic attack in the Suns arena. And I came to that stark realization that my little family was now being hunted. The church just suddenly just held a sense of danger about it in my life. It was a very odd, unfamiliar feeling for me, as if strangers had come in and kind of nestled between me and the walls of my spiritual home, just preparing to enucleate me from God, family, and the church that I loved. And on top of that, my children, they also felt a danger from the exclusion policy. It was a threat of their eternal connection to their father. Just 18 months previous, my children had just gone through the dissolution of their parents' mixed orientation marriage. And I was doing all I could to hold us together and to deal with the trauma of divorce. And then all of a sudden, the exclusion policy hit us as we were recovering. And if I married again, according to my orientation, how my heart opens towards love, through no fault of my children, they would be punished. I would incur a no questions asked excommunication as an apostate. And that would force me to witness not only the damnation of my children's own spiritual progress in the church, but also their violent unsealing from me through my excommunication. And the church had just become a gatekeeper of love for me and for all core Latter-day Saints. It declared our love for another as apostasy. It declared our love for the gospel of Jesus Christ apostasy if we married again. Mm-hmm. So as I yearned for remarriage, the church just, it stood between me and the love of my children. It was almost making me asking me to make a choice between the love and testimony I had of the church and the love I dearly had, eternal love for my children. And I just thought, I am here trying my hardest to build and strengthen my family in this life. And I felt that suddenly the church was determined to just destroy my family in the next life. And I just consistently thought, is the church really so afraid of same-sex marriage within the walls of Zion that they were prepared to sacrifice children to keep it out? It just seems so incredulous to me that the children were being punished. I remember sitting my children down that Sunday after the exclusion policy dropped, and I sat down and I read it to them. I explained to them what was happening. And when I got done, my 11-year-old son, who was preparing to be ordained a deacon in the priesthood, he just looked at me, tears in his eyes, and he just said, "Dad, why do they want to do this to us?" And I just said, "Son, I don't know. I just don't know." And in that moment, I realized that my children, they needed a voice, and they needed a voice of their father. And it really awoke within me the courage and the strength to protect my children from the harm that they were feeling from this policy. And this was not an isolated event. This happened really throughout the entire swath of the queer sexual minorities in the church. And we banded together to create a community, give support for ourselves after we all of a sudden felt the bottom fall out of the supportive community that we had felt somewhat, in the church before the exclusion policy. And, I think in my essay, I said we were just shouting as loudly as we could affirmations into this queer Latter-day Saint intersection. That was the only way we could broadcast supportive community. We were providing suicide prevention care. We were literally telling parents just to wait and things are better. We are here for you. It was a moment that I realized the extreme importance of building supportive community for ourselves as gender and sexual minorities in the church. Oftentimes, if we don't do it for ourselves, then no one's going to do it for us.
Wow. Well, thank you. Thank you for sharing that. It's very vulnerable and just shattering time. It breaks my heart to hear that story about yourself with your kids at the game and then your 11-year-old's response. I remember other conversations I had in the days following that announcement of people saying, you know, with the Supreme Court decision to allow same-sex marriage, like, we thought something would happen, but we didn't think they'd go for the kids. And yeah, that was the part that was really the gut punch, I think.
But I remember, you know, usually apostles, they, no matter the dispensation, you know, even in Jesus's time, the apostles tried to keep the children away from him. So it's something that we see through the dispensations that we have to work on to be better as humans, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Tell me more about, so Nathan, you described this bubble of belonging before 2015 and how there was this sort of time where it seems like the church was maybe opening up and that relationship was getting better between the church and the queer community. People were, queer members were maybe feeling like there was a path for them inside the church. And then the exclusion policy comes out and that is just smashed. Do you think that space was ever sustainable, or do you think it was always going to collapse and the policy kind of hurried it along?
Yeah, you know, I think it's interesting because there were some ground rules that was set as the church began to try to rehabilitate its image after the Prop 208, California Prop 8 in 2008. It really did a 180. It started working with and talking with queer activists. We saw the benefits of that when the church recalled their operatives from California and instructed them to work with activists in Utah, which resulted in the creation of the Salt Lake City Anti-Discrimination Act. And eventually in 2015, the Utah Compromise, which protected LGBTQ people from discrimination in housing and employment in Utah. It was a win-win situation where the church was finding common ground with queer activists. It was very remarkable. In fact, they still do this. I think there's probably no other church in America that is as conservative as the Church of Jesus Christ, Christ of Latter-day Saints, that has such a really firm, good relationship, knowing queer activists by name as they work with one another and have tension with one another in the political and legal arenas. So in about 2012, the church also needed to rehabilitate its internal way that it was treating queer people. And it had to do this because the members were starting to revolt. I mean, they were not happy to have queer politics in the pews, right? It's not a good thing for them. And there was a great deal of members who just were tired of how the queer children of God were being treated within the church. They needed and wanted change. And that happened. In December of 2012, the Mormon and Gay website was revealed. And we heard, you know, there were video messages. It was a remarkable, we were hearing for the first time that we were wanted and that we belonged, and the church was asking queer people to stay in the church. This was in 2012. This really kind of opened up this bubble of belonging, and people started feeling it. They were coming in because we felt like we were wanted. And so we came into this space The queer leaders, I noticed the president of Affirmation, Randall Thacker, at the time, even met personally with Elder Christofferson. And Elder Christofferson promised him in person in his office that over time things will get better.
Hmm.
And this really inspired this hope that things would get better. And as we in the Latter-day Saint community saw the church working with and making things better in the outside political arena, when the legal system compromising, finding common ground, we started following the same rules. Dialogue began with the church. It was remarkable. There had never been dialogue with the church's internal queer population before. Affirmation was talking with the church. So many organizations were coming up on their own, really fulfilling the Doctrine and Covenants, section that talks about, you know, God wants us to be anxiously engaged in all good causes. So many people were anxiously engaged in building, in knitting queer people into the fabric of the restoration. And it seemed like the church was tolerating what was happening. And it all was happening because there was an assumption of a good faith relationship. So if there was this good faith relationship, meaning that the assumption that this was a space that would hold that very vulnerable area of continuum revelation, change, moving forward, evolving, together, the bubble could have continued.
Yeah.
But in actuality, queer Latter-day Saints don't exist on common ground like our queer activists do. We exist on church ground. And on church ground, there is no negotiation. There's no synodality here. There was no discussions like equals. We were just being held there, told that we belonged, but there would really be no change. And so there was still a great power differential in this relationship. And so, we found that out on November the 5th, 2015.
Yeah.
One arm of the church was talking about us belonging. We were actually talking with that arm of the church. There was another arm of the church that was working actively for our exclusion. And so when the exclusion policy happened, the bottom just fell out of that. So in the way that we now realize that that relationship was, it wasn't a healthy relationship. It wasn't a relationship of equals. And so that could not have continued at that point. So yeah, it was destined to go. And I, believe the church felt very vulnerable, maybe even legally vulnerable once Obergefell fell. And they felt like they needed to protect themselves by laying out clear boundaries because they didn't want the church, the government to come in like it did during polygamy and reach for the doctrine on family and marriage.
Right.
And so they really protected themselves. So yeah, I just didn't see that as sustainable. And it really changed the entire landscape. And we see that today in queer advocacy in the church.
Yeah. It's interesting how the echoes of polygamy seem to have influenced this so much. And Makoto, you get into that. I was really struck by how polygamy became the thing that helped you understand queerness. So why do you think that clicked for you more? Why did that click for you in that way? You described this moment of listening to Kate Holbrook and how this shifts the ground for you. Would you describe that for listeners?
Of course. So to bring up another thing I somehow did not notice, right? And thinking back to that earlier question, I did have LGBTQ friends. I went to a public school. There were people around me who were gay, lesbian, transgender even. And they were very patient friends. They were very understanding with my flubs, with my missteps. But I also, I believe in being a kind person and in loving others. And so I think I made an effort to not confront, to avoid, expressing prejudice and bigotry and unkindness. And yet I somehow still generally conceived of them as like, well, that's them. They are LGBTQ, and I am a Latter-day Saint, right? I felt, I experienced, I imagined, I thought of us as they're going through something and I'm going through something else. And that's just how that is. The way plural marriage comes into this is that plural marriage is another form of sexual alterity, of sexual difference that I was uncomfortable with. I didn't like it being in the church's past. It was always awkward and weird that 1 week of Sunday school where it comes up in the youth curriculum from the Doctrine and Covenants, and we all just sort of breathlessly rush through it and maybe parrot some half-hearted apologetics, and none of us, like the students, us kids, we didn't seem to believe it. The teachers didn't seem to believe it. No one really knew what to do with it except to sort of try to have faith about it. And then Saints Volume 1 comes out, and Kate Holbrook and I believe Matt Groh are doing this video presentation, this live face-to-face discussion with Elder Quentin L. Cook. And they get questions, you know, from youth. And one of the questions is, of course, about how do I talk about plural marriage and the history of polygamy with people? And so the moment the ground shifted from it was when Kate Holbrook answers, she's working for the church history department, and says that there were some women, some people, Muslim members of the church who participated in plural marriage and found it very difficult. And then she kept talking and she added, and there were some for whom it was very meaningful. And when polygamy ended, they were heartbroken and they cried. Why did, and that somehow shifted the ground. Why did that click when other things didn't? My best sense of it is that, you know, suddenly the call was coming from inside the house now, right? These were not, you know, neighbors to whom I should, you know, be polite and loving and kind, but who were experiencing something different. Now I was hearing like, wait, this was an example of faith you're selling me. This was not just an example of faith, but of something they appreciated and valued. That this experience wasn't some wrong thing that is a grand mystery in our past, but rather it was, the way I put it in the essay was that it had not occurred to me it was possible to want to not be straight, to not be normal, right? Not to say that being in a plural marriage is the same as being gay or being trans, but it's not the same as being monogamous.
Yeah,
it's not the same as being quote unquote normal. And now that it was sort of, now that I was seeing like, wait, these are people I should look up to. These are people being, you know, you get Volume 2 and you get all these different plural wives as, you know, leading characters in the book. People who like, whose examples of faith are like being sort of model, being presented as something to admire. And the more I saw them, the more I thought about me. And does that mean that feeling different, experiencing desires, experiencing feelings and senses of myself that apparently are different from what other people feel? It suddenly made that seem not a thing to be held outside of me, but maybe that is actually part of me. And the one other way I think it makes it click is that thinking of polygamy through the idea of queerness, it made these two different puzzles. Like, why is the church have this policy about queerness when that, you know, seems to hurt people we care about? Why did the church do this thing with polygamy when that's like weird and wrong? When I made them into one puzzle, it sort of solved each other. It's like, oh, the church is reacting to its past by lashing out to these others in the present.
Yeah.
Yes.
And so that's sort of the two reasons it clicked. It brought it inside of my own community, and they sort of turn two puzzles into one solution, or if not a solution, one understanding.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You're the way you work through that in the essay is so good, and I think very convincing, and also just very empathetic and compassionate, the way you approach it. So I feel like a better person from reading it. I want to close by asking you both a question about how your sense of belonging within a Latter-day Saint context has evolved over the past decade, and what, if anything, is giving you hope today? And I'm trying to ask that with some sensitivity, because I know hope is a difficult thing to talk about right now in many ways in our world. But I think it's also one of the most important things that we talk about. So two questions that I'm smashing into one, but what has evolved and changed for you? And what are you, what's anchoring you to hope today? Nathan, you want to go first?
Oh, sure. Yes. Absolutely. The exclusion policy, it helped me see and really understand that the church is not a monolith. I can almost see it like as a triad of distinct faces. You know, first, we have the institutional church, and we often call the institutional church Salt Lake, headquarters of the modern church. As D. Michael Quinn argues, it's the modern church is the institutional church right now in this era of wealth and corporate power. It's characterized by a sophisticated bureaucracy, a well-defined chain of command, and legal savvy, and is fueled by wealth and social power. And this is where the policies are given and removed. But really, our experience of the institutional level of the church as queer Latter-day Saints is often filtered through the second face of the church, which is the local church. In wards and stakes that are governed by local leaders, that leadership roulette becomes the defining factor of the queer experience. While the institutional hierarchy may set top-down policies, local leaders often act as either a buffer against or a catalyst for church-inflicted trauma derived from those policies. And so this creates a patchwork landscape of policy enforcement where, for example, a same-sex couple may be excommunicated in one stake while finding refuge in the next. The third face of the church is the ecclesia, and it's sometimes theologians refer to this is the invisible church. You know, this is the church at its most fundamental definition, the body of believers. These are the rank and file members. These are our families and friends. These are our neighbors. These are the people who sit outside the institutional power centers, but who sit next to us in the pews. The ecclesia often act as a paradox. It can hold our most powerful advocates or our most significant stumbling blocks. And on an affirming level, the ecclesia often works by creating just a place, a breathing room for us in the church. And through acts of solidarity, the members of the ecclesia will sit with us during church discipline. They'll wear a rainbow pin. They'll wish us happy Pride Month in front of the entire congregation. You know, they will remain your friends even if you choose to step away. Mm-hmm. You know, their existence doesn't make the entire church safe, but they have, in that moment, made that place you choose to be a place that you can feel belonging. And so together, these three faces of the church, they form a volatile ecosystem that is rarely static. At one point, you can be belonging, like many of our transgender friends did before the 2024 transgender exclusion policy, and a policy comes out and all of a sudden nothing changed for you, but the goalposts have now moved and now you find yourself outside of belonging, no longer able to use the restroom that you need to use, no longer to go to priesthood or relief society according to how you need to go. And so it's It's this is when the ecclesia becomes our best effort in feeling belonging in the church, because they are with us and they will stay with us and they love us and they know us and they are rooted right in the second great commandment of loving our neighbors. And this is where we have the most effect when we do any kind of advocacy work in the church, is calling in our family, our friends, our neighbors into our circle of love as queer people. And this is really where belonging is best centered. This really is where all of our energies are best used as a queer people in the church, is with the ecclesia to build these communities of safety, love, and hope. And I think that's one of the greatest things that I learned from the exclusion policy, is no matter what the institutional church says or does, I have a church, I have an ecclesia who love me and care for me and who are there for me and who are a part of me and who understand me and what I am going through and who will listen to me. And that is, I think, one of the most powerful things for me. And it provides that hope that I can be a part of a body as, you know, the institutional church is figuring things out. I mean, who knows when that's going to be, but that's not my responsibility. My responsibility is creating for me and for others these communities that maybe someday won't be so invisible, but for right now, create the very base and foundation of what it means to be a part of the church.
Oh, that's beautiful. That's really beautiful. Thank you for sharing that, Nathan. Makoto?
So, how has my sense or thinking about belonging in the church and in a Latter-day Saint context evolved? One big change that comes to mind is, right, so first, in 2015, didn't even know about the exclusion policy.
Yeah.
I eventually learned about it around the time it's rescinded. And at the time, I thought to myself, you know, my egg was still uncracked. I didn't even know I was trans. And I thought to myself, well, it's nice that it's over, but I understand why it happened. Like, why would anyone want to send, you know, their family into a community that will teach them to, you know, disapprove of their parents' relationship, to maybe hate their parents even? What a terrible thing. Why would you want to be somewhere you aren't wanted? What's changed is that I've realized that belonging and being part of a community is a lot more complicated than that. You know, there have been times, there was a time when I considered, when I wasn't really participating as a Latter-day Saint, and I wasn't sure if I really identified that way even. And I looked for other communities. I cast about for where else I might belong. And in the end, I came back to what felt like home. You know, people can ask me, they do ask me, like, why even try? Why try to be a Latter-day Saint? Why try to be part of Mormonism or whatever we call it? And, you know, why would you choose that? And I think there's part of me that realizes, like, I don't know if I choose it. I don't know if I chose it any more than I chose to be trans. I did choose in the sense that I chose to transition. I did choose in the sense that I chose to be baptized or that I choose to sit in the pews. But I also didn't choose. I never chose to want this. And maybe that's okay. I don't know if I need to choose it. Maybe I just need to want it. This is a thorny feeling, because it doesn't always lead to hope. Sometimes the experience of being trans, the experience of being a Latter-day Saint, sometimes it's the experience of realizing that what you want doesn't always get you what you want. There's a lot of days where I would say, like, not much gives me hope. I don't mean to be too gloomy or you know, doomsday about things. But it's just, it is, I mean, it's part of it. It's part of the experience. But still, you know, I get up every day, I wake up and I do things. I mean, I guess the two things that give hope are one, that I've survived so far. And to any, and to, and that's what I would say to a lot of people, right? You've survived so far, and you don't know that you won't make it through another day. And that can be really discouraging sometimes, but hope, but it can also, you know, be clarifying. In a brighter note, though, much like what Nathan said, it's when we create community, it's when we, you know, have that invisible church, that also is where there's a lot of hope. I think some of the most interesting advice I got was that as tempting as it is to try to, you know, seize the means of production, so to speak, not to necessarily use it in a Marxian sense, but like as tempting as it is to get on that committee, to get in that decision room, to be that president, as tempting as it is, it's a very self-destructive process. You end up compromising and burning yourself up in the effort to gain control of an institution that isn't in your control. Maybe we do need a bit of that fighting, but what we need more immediately are places of rest outside of that, to build communities of our own, institutions of our own, and eventually we'll come back to the table and hash things out and build a different relationship. But until then, we need to have a room of our own. And those rooms are out there. And they can be made. Yeah. You know, there's places like Affirmation, there's other organizations, there's even smaller groups, there's friendships, there's, you know, yeah. So it's possible to make a community, and eventually the church will walk over and ask, hey, that seems to be working out. And you get in there too.
Yeah. Oh, that's so beautiful. I'm really brought to tears by both of you. Both of these essays are so important, really powerful, really moving. It was an honor to read them. It's been an honor to speak to both of you today. I feel heartened by speaking to you. So thank you both. I really appreciate your willingness to share.
Likewise. Thanks so much for inviting us. And it means a lot to be able to share all this.
It does. To have a platform to be able to speak our truths is just really wonderful. It's part of our supportive community.
Yeah. Yeah. And speaking with you has made clear how important that is. So thank you, Nathan and Makto, for your honesty and care in this conversation and for the work you've contributed to the roundtable. You can read both of these essays in the spring issue of Dialogue, a Journal of Mormon Thought, in the roundtable marking 10 years since the 2015 policy. As always, thank you for listening to Dialogue Out Loud. If this conversation resonated with you, we invite you to read, reflect, and continue the conversation in your own communities. Until next time.
Greetings, my name is Rebecca DeSchweinitz, and I'm thrilled to serve as a board member at the Dialogue Foundation and as one of the hosts of Dialogue Gospel Study. In each episode, which we record live the second and fourth Sunday of every month, we welcome esteemed speakers from a variety of backgrounds to share their insights and perspectives on the Come Follow Me lessons. Our aim is to spark meaningful conversations about the scriptures, to connect them to our personal experiences and to our understandings and explorations of the gospel. To stay in the loop with our upcoming lessons and this opportunity to engage with Mormon thought, culture, and belief, be sure to visit dialoguejournal.com and sign up for our newsletter. By doing so, you'll receive updates and timely links to join our live stream lessons. Additionally, you can catch up on our past guests and episodes by subscribing to Dialogue Journal on YouTube, Facebook, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Dialogue Podcast Network.